Kia ora, kia manuia, aloha, aroha nui. Welcome to On The Brink Radio, broadcast number 284. This is being recorded on Tuesday, the 25th of June, 2019. This is Jeff Phillips Weverson coming at ya once again from the beautiful Aotea, Great Barrier Island, New Zealand. I'm now out with one of my very closest friends, not only on Aotea, but in all of the Southern Hemisphere. And not only is she non-human, she's not even of the animal kingdom. I call her, for lack of knowing her true name, we know her as Grandmother Puputakaua. Puputakaua is a type of tree that's indigenous to New Zealand. Maybe it occurs on some other South Pacific islands in this area, but it's a very distinctive, they call it New Zealand's Christmas tree because they have beautiful red flowers in December, but they get to be really, really huge, and they don't grow so tall like redwoods or oaks, but they grow out. They have giant, really huge trunks, maybe the size of a Volkswagen Beetle, and many, many large limbs that kind of branch out, and they'll bow down and go down onto the ground like elbows or tentacles, and then they'll rise up again, and they're known for their ability to grow out of rocky cliff sides and hanging out over the ocean and hanging on in places where other trees wouldn't stand a chance. And Grandmother Puputakaua, I'm actually sitting literally in her very bosom now. She's got her right hand main limb coming out, sort of encircles the most perfect campsite that I've ever had anywhere. And I'm not camping out today, but we'll be back soon. But I came to record this show because we've been here many times before, me and my family of Kaitiaki family creatures, Teddy, Wally, Ruby Ann, Big Teddy, Heidi, Phil, Huck, Bear, Snooch, Freddy, and Ellie the elephant. We've sat right on the exact spot where I am now and recorded several interspecies, interkingdom dialogues or interviews with Grandmother Puputakaua and the Kingdom of the Birds, the Kingdom of the Star Nations. Even Mother Earth dropped in on one of our conversations once, and I believe Teoa, the Sun, and maybe even the Milky Way galaxy. But today, mate, we're going to be talking about what I call the Inky Window. That's E-N-C-K-E. The Inky Window. This show is entitled The Inky Window: Comets, Asteroids, Rogue Civilizations, and the Atlantean Discontinuity. Now, these are all topics that I've touched on before. But it's very interesting because for the past few years, I've really become interested in comets and asteroids, which are, in essence, pretty much the same thing. I think really the only technical difference is that comets undergo a processing called outgassing, where they emit trails of vapor and or plasma that gives them a visibility that asteroids don't have. Asteroids, unless you're able to sort of photograph it optically, which would be a tiny little dot moving against a relatively stationary background of stars. If you can't do that, the only way you're going to see an asteroid is if it turns into a meteor and starts burning up as it comes through the Earth's atmosphere. Whereas a comet, when it gets within a certain distance of the Sun, starts. Now, there's a couple of different schools of thought. The standard model is that the heat from the Sun creates outgassing, which is leaves a vapor trail that has nothing to do with the angular momentum of the comet, but has to do with its orientation towards the Sun. So the trail of the comet is always going to be pointing directly away from the Sun, as if the Sun is blowing it off the comet, as I understand it. Now, in the electric universe model, the emissions or the trail of the comet could be plasma, electromagnetic, which would make it more subject to electromagnetic fields and properties. It's probably elements of both of these. What's very interesting is that a massive amount of geological evidence exists, and as well as cultural information in the stories of almost every people on this planet, that we've had catastrophic encounters with heavenly bodies countless times over the eons that humanity existed, and these are all recorded with a good bit of trepidation because of the chaos and turmoil that ensued, and that people had to do their best to live through with a great degree of uncertainty. This is kind of like a common theme running through, I would say, all, not that I certainly haven't researched it all, but it's believed that every culture would have stories of cataclysmic events being created from celestial bodies impacting or passing close to the Earth, and especially the work of Dr. Emmanuel Wielakowski, who I've talked about many, many, many times, one of my favorite, and to me, one of the most brilliant minds of the 20th century, a psychoanalyst who started delving into common themes that he saw in the mythologies of different cultures, and revolving around exactly what I'm talking about, floods, cataclysms. And so he wrote his first book, Worlds in Collision, looking at that. Then his second book, Earth in Upheaval, is a look at the strictly geological evidence for the Earth having been impacted by celestial bodies countless times. And he talks about what he calls cataclysmic evolution, where the effects of these impacts have had equal to or possibly greater influence on the evolution of life and the creation of new ecological niches and new species and the different turns that life has taken over the billions of years that we've been here, that these catastrophic encounters with heavenly bodies have had a lot more to do with all this than has the long, slow, uniformitarian process of natural selection described by Darwin and Lyell. So again, it's probably elements of both of these, but I think that the catastrophic thing, even though there is a whole school of astronomical thought and geological thought called catastrophism, I think it's sort of come and gone a few different times and had its day and been put on the back burner and been in fashion and fallen out of fashion. But I think the main thing is because everything we call history has only been a few thousand years, and we can't hardly even remember what happened last week, much less 5,000 years ago. It's quite muddy and foggy. But so 5,000 years is absolutely, that's like a trillionth of a picosecond in the time of Mother Earth and the geological timescale during which life has evolved and existed on Mother Earth, so we believe. So just the fact that we haven't seen any of these impacts during what we call civilization makes us think that it's a thing of the past. But the point of this show and the point of a lot of my research and awareness in recent years has been that, au contraire, this is not the case. A large amount of very credible evidence exists that not only could a catastrophic impact with a celestial body happen pretty much any time, regardless of the fact that people think, oh yeah, NASA's got satellites and telescopes up there looking in the Air Force and the military, they've got our space fence and we've got HAARP and we can send up nuclear missiles to blow it up like in that movie Deep Impact and all this stuff. But when you really start looking into it, this is really, you know, this is not the case at all. And not only is it highly probable or inevitable that we will again have a planetary-wide catastrophic event due to a celestial impact, not only could that happen any time, but based on a lot of really, really significant astronomical research, calculations, and assembling of information, as I understand it, beginning with two British or Scottish astronomers Victor Klube and William Napier, Bill Napier. The two most likely times of each year where the probability of encountering a fragment of a comet is actually right now, the latter part of June into the early part of July, and the latter part of October into the early part of November. These are two, I'm sort of expressing this as two windows of time, each lasting about 2 weeks, but you know, again, this is very, very relative. But I call these the inky windows because these are the two times when the Earth passes through the orbital trajectory of the daughter fragment remnants of Comet Encke, who is believed to have been a huge supercomet on the order of maybe 100 kilometers in diameter that has been orbiting the Earth for a really long time. And apparently, I started doing some research last night into Victor Klube's and Napier's book called The Cosmic Winter. But apparently, Encke is the only comet whose orbit prevents it from being perturbed by Saturn and Jupiter. There's these, a type of comet, because of their orbits, they're called the Apollo, the Apollonian comets. There's a lot of them, maybe hundreds, but they all, their orbits tend to be perturbated and mutated and eccentricated by the gravitational influence of Saturn and Jupiter, so that eventually they'll escape the solar system. But not Encke. Encke is also the comet with the shortest period. It comes around every 3.2 to 3.5 years, and it's just below naked eye visibility. But it comes around that often, and twice a year, the Earth passes through its orbital trajectory, consisting of clouds of dust and debris and fragments of when it's collided with or been gravitationally disrupted by other bodies. And it's believed that Encke itself, as the supercomet, may have been responsible for a part of it, could have been responsible for the Chicxulub impact in the Yucatan 65 million years ago, that's believed to have initiated that whole mass extinction sequence that took out the dinosaurs. This was really popularized, this theory, and the credit to it given to William and Louis Alvarez, the father and son geologist Manhattan Project physicist team, who came out with this, I think it was as early as the 1990s when they came out with this idea. But when I was interviewing astronomer Fred Watson of the Anglo-Australian Observatory in Australia a couple of years ago, he is from England, and he actually knew these guys, Victor Klube and Bill Napier, and he said that it was them who originally came out with this idea of the mass extinction being caused by or initiated by a cometary impact, but that the Alvarez team stole their thunder somehow, however that happened. Their main thing was based on the discovery of a planet-wide layer of this isotope, or it's a radioactive isotope of iridium, which is an element in the same family as platinum. They found a layer of this all over the whole planet that would suggest it being dispersed by this cometary impact. But the really interesting thing is that the Encke window, the Encke windows. Now, last night I was reading in Napier's book, it said that some people say that the Encke window of this time of year goes all the way from April through June. But we do know, for example, that in 1908 there was what is still the largest explosion ever experienced or measured that's taken place on the Earth, far greater than any number of nuclear weapons detonated or any kind of industrial or military explosion or accident. It's called the Tunguska event that happened near Tunguska, I think in Siberia, northern Russia, very remote region, but apparently eyewitnesses saw this very bright object coming through the sky, and then it exploded in what they call an airburst before it hit the ground, but it leveled the trees for thousands of kilometers, and it left a circular lake that's there now that some people believe is kind of the water-filled crater from this event. But that this event happened on June 30th, 1908, right in the middle of the June-July Inkiwondo. And in Napier's book last night I was reading, he talks about how that monks witnessed a giant meteorite collision on the moon that also happened during the Inkiwondo. I can tell you more about that in my blog post. And also, now this ties in with the very much the bigger picture of really what it is that I'm doing with my life. It has to do with the connection between the whales and dolphins and the indigenous people, primarily of Australia, the whale dreaming people, and this what I call cetacean dreamtime astronomy, the knowledge that whales and dolphins, and probably other beings too, but whales and dolphins being sentient, conscious beings with brains and nervous systems more evolved than ours, and they've had it for far longer than we have, that they have advanced knowledge of astronomical information, not only theoretical and information from the past, but they're able to sense what's going on in the solar system and the heliocosm and in the nearby interstellar neighborhood. They're able to know about this and sense it in using means that we probably couldn't even understand, even if they were able to explain it to us. But this is a big part of my work, is trying to understand not only what this information is, but secondarily how they know it. And I think some of it might have to do with sound. Some of it might have to do with being intimately involved with water. Like Mother Ocean is one giant molecule or liquid crystal of water that would be connected in ways that science can and also cannot understand or explain, having to do with bodies of water on other planets and other star systems, which might harbor life as we know or don't know her. Some people theorize that the whales and dolphins came from another planet in another star system with water. Maybe someday they'll be able to tell us, but I hope, hopefully it won't be in English. But I think that you're able to come to understand knowledge like this, A, as you're ready for it, meaning that you're not going to go and try to publish books about it and do workshops and charge people for you to tell them about it. You're not going to capitalize on it. And B, you've got to be quiet enough and silent enough within yourself and coherent enough and have the ability to shut out all the anthropogenic noise and acoustic and information toxicity so that you can become a clearer receptor to these fields of energy and information. And this has to do with understanding the voice and the messages of all of nature, of Mitikaya Yasin, of all of our family of life, not just the whales and dolphins, but this information is of particular relevance because it has to do with the planetary level catastrophic events that have punctuated the existence and evolution of life on Mother Earth. And it's not a thing of the past. The important thing to realize is that an event like this could happen anytime. And that's what I'm leading up to. There's a lot of evidence that, for example, there's these Czechoslovakian astronomers who came out with a really cool paper a couple of years ago talking about how they feel like that they've discovered new huge fragments of the Inky comet nucleus that are not visible to us, but they're there. Maybe they've detected them gravitationally, but they're obscured behind these clouds of dust. But that these are, there's many of them, and that they're large enough that an impact could take out a whole continent. And we're not just talking about something being blown up. The real danger would happen after an impact, in the wake of it, as the vibrations settle down, but then probably a whole chain of global volcanism would start happening that would start choking the whole atmosphere with smoke and all kinds of chemical toxins and stuff. And so that in itself, and the lava flows, that would be, and the darkness and the cold, the lack of sunlight and the inability of plants to photosynthesize, and then all the animals wouldn't have any food. This is how the chain of events would work. And it could go on for hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands or maybe even hundreds of thousands of years from one impact. We just don't have any way of knowing. But anyway, this is something I've talked about on my show before. In late October of 2015, I was here on Great Barrier Island, and I'd been out here with Grandmother Putakawa, and I had a didgeridoo with me that I was trying to learn how to play, and I was making some sounds, and I was down on the beach playing it, and I looked out and saw some dolphins. So I tried to blow some didge sounds at the dolphins, and I psychically asked them if they would come over to the beach where I stay, called Arafura. And lo and behold, the next day, there were some dolphins there. And my guess is that they're the same ones, but not only did they come there, they hung out for about a week or more. They were there every day. I'd go out and swim with them and hang out, play my flute and my drum. Really, really, really super cool. It's the longest lasting encounter with dolphins I've had anywhere. And so there was this one day when I was out there with both my cameras, and I was standing in water over my waist with my still and video cameras, and I was filming the dolphins because they were doing some really interesting maneuvers. They weren't surfing on a wave. When a wave would come, they would shoot down through the wave lengthwise at just a blinding speed, so fast, just for a couple of seconds. And it was just really, really, really cool to watch them doing that. And I had to make myself get out of the water to go and do some painting. And I went back to my table, and I was sitting there painting, and all of a sudden, a very powerful image appeared in my mind, just out of the blue. And I'm a very visual person, but this was a very unique phenomenon that I'd never experienced before. And I was certain that this image had been telepathically transmitted to me by the dolphins. And I'm familiar with that kind of thing. They're known for doing that. So anyway, what blew me away was that I knew what this was an image of. Not a literal, not a photographic image, but sort of a pictographic retinal or neural representation of a specific thing. And it blew me away when I realized what it was. It was an image, an impression of what a comet or asteroid might look like as it's coming through the atmosphere, but if it's coming straight towards where you are, not streaking across the sky, going sideways from horizon to horizon, but coming straight at you. So it would be pretty much a circular object that would be increasing in intensity, and maybe with streamers coming off. But what I gathered from this transmission was that the dolphins were telling me, A, that in their collective memory this image exists, that their ancestors of whatever distance, we have no way of knowing, but their ancestors witnessed something like this and lived to tell, lived to share it with others. But B, even more spookily, was the implication that something like this was getting ready to happen again soon. And this totally blew me away, and it just completely rocked my whole reality, and has ever since then. And this was almost 4 years ago. So since then, I've really gone to the next level with trying to understand the leading edge of knowledge about comets and asteroids, and Victor Klub and Bill Napier are the leading exponents of this idea. And I've been trying to get in touch with them. They're both in their 80s now, and hopefully they're both still compos mentis. But I've painted really nice rocks with dolphins and comets on them that I would like to give them in honor of their beautiful contributions. But I'm reading their books and delving into all this information. One of their concepts It's called episodic bombardment. And so they're looking at long-term episodic bombardments of the Earth. And what they're looking at, a really huge galactic picture of the as the sun moves through different parts of the spiral arms of the galaxy, how we might encounter different amounts of objects and stuff. But then, you know, when you start looking into what we know about comets and asteroids and how many there are and all the different orbital planes that they have, there's lots. There's like possibly even millions. Another really interesting thing is that right now we're in the middle of what the Maldi call Matariki. That's the Maldi name for the Pleiades, the Seven Sisters, the little open star cluster that's in the shoulder of Taurus the Bull, which is, Taurus is the constellation from which the main meteor stream of Comet Encke radiates. The Taurid meteors are in November. But it makes me wonder, because especially Klug and Napier are talking about how, probably just a few hundred years ago, that Encke was much brighter, and that was seen shuttling around within the zodiac, just like the planets do, only faster. So imagine that, an object as bright as Jupiter or Venus shuttling around within the zodiac constantly, but it's a comet. Probably with a tail or a trail. So this is not that long ago, but could it be that Matariki, as a festival or a ceremony, may have had something to do with honoring this celestial event of the Encke meteor shower, the Taurids, that originated from within Taurus, which is where the Pleiades is. So the Pleiades, Matariki, could have been where the meteor stream tended to come from. And people would have been very, not spooked by this, but they would be very wary of what this might mean. They might look at it as omens of the sky beings. It's not impossible that there may have even been bolides, you know, giant meteors that came that would explode, or there could have been smaller versions of comets or asteroids that were small, that were like meteors. But imagine a meteor coming straight at you. It may not be that big, but it wouldn't be making a trail. It would just be getting brighter and brighter and brighter until then hopefully it burned up before it hit. But so, you know, there could be all kinds of different instances like this that we just don't really know about. In all my work and my radio show, I talk about the Hopi prophecy and the Day of Purification a lot, because I believe that this is a real prophecy, having met Thomas Banyaka in 1986. And I don't pretend to understand really what's going on, but there's a lot of evidence, like we were talking about Emmanuel Wielikowski and from the Hindus, there's a lot of evidence of cyclical time patterns that go on, seasons of a galactic year. You could call them the yugas, you could call them the incarnations of the world that the Hopi talk about. We don't really have any specific time frames, but it's pretty clear that sort of seasons, we pass through a different kind of seasons. And these seasons may affect life here, they may affect us, but like right now, it seems to me that the only thing that's wrong on Mother Earth is because of what we're doing. You know, so it seems like if we're passing through a field of some kind of influence, why would it only influence us and make us go crazy, but not all the whales and dolphins and not all the other plants and the kingdoms of life? But it could be that these influences are still there, but just that we're the only ones that are susceptible to it because of neurological or neurobiological mutations that we've undergone. So when you look at all the comets and asteroids and the cataclysms of the past, the floods and the destruction coming from the sky, the Theomachy, the war of the gods, as Wielikowski calls it, a lot of people thought they took the teleological perspective that humanity or certain people were being punished because of evil deeds, because they hadn't been living in the right way. Whereas modern science would poo-poo that and go like, oh, not the case, it's just random. Random collision. So to me, one of the great mysteries of being here now is to try to reconcile both of these perspectives, that the day of purification needs to come soon in order to relieve Mother Earth of the burden of the impacts of man the wise, to heal Koyaanisqatsi and to rid the Earth of the Homo sapien macrovirus. But whatever she has to do to take us out is going to endanger the lives of countless other beings. And that's the admonition of Thomas Banyakya, that we cannot hope to avert the day of purification, but that we can hope to lessen its severity through all the good actions that we can do and all of the things we can do and not do that show that we love life and Mother Earth. We can make the purification less severe on behalf of all the non-human life forms that are already suffering because of us. So will the day of purification come soon? And will it be due to a comet or asteroid impact? I personally think that the answer to both of these questions is yes. But how soon? I don't have any idea. But the thing is, based on astronomical knowledge, of which I'm trying to delve into ever more deeply, both through human astronomers and through the knowledge that I think the whales and dolphins have, right now, late June, early July, and late October, early November, are two windows of time, which I call the inky window, where we are most likely to encounter a fragment of comet Encke. So it's a really important time to turn your head and your eyes and your heart to the skies and think about our cosmic context and the impact of what we call progress and civilization is having on all of life. Thanks for listening. Enjoy Matcha Riki. Now, I'm going to ask Grandmother Pohutukawa. Grandmother Pohutukawa, is it okay for me and the critters to come back and camp out with you again soon?
Wavyops, I would be so, so enchanted, enchanté, amigo, for you all to come back and camp out with me. I'm sorry you can't stay longer today, but it's been beautiful having you, and we want you to come. Can you stay for two nights this time? I'll give you extra special inspiration, and we'll talk with the Pleiades, Teoa, and the Galactic Core, and maybe some supernova remnants.
Oh my God, Grandmother Pohutukawa, you know all those celestial beings.
Of course we do, Wavyops. We're the kingdom of the plants. We've been on Mother Earth for billions of years here, communicating with ways that you wouldn't even begin to imagine how cool they are.
Oh my God, that's going to be so cool, Grandmother Pohutukawa. Thank you for having us. One of my next shows is going to be an interview with Norwegian guitarist Erik Wallo, or Volo, W-O-L-L-O. He's recorded with a really cool musician named Steve Roach. I've also recorded a recent interview with Terry, Mr. Limpet Lily, my marine biologist friends in Kauai. And I'm going to be recording a show about our mind share, how we use our attention and the content of our mind. Are we walking around as oxygen thieves with wasted protoplasm, or are we trying to be kaitiakis on a path with heart? Very interesting how we use our time, what we occupy our mental mind share with. Does it matter? Is it okay to go around and just watch some soap operas and wonder what you're going to do? Or does every thought you think every second matter in the grand scheme of things? Does every thought you think and everything that you do affect the severity of the purification, which I think is absolutely essential, because there's no way humanity can undo all the destructive stuff that we've unleashed and continue to. Even if we wanted to, we're not even showing any signs that we want to, but even if we did, how are we going to possibly undo, correct, fix, repair, or compensate for example, the global nuclear scenario alone? That's where I really have to honor my beautiful sister, Dr. Rosalie Bertel, a true Rachel Carson of today. Anyway, this is Jeff Phillips Wefferson signing off. Here on Atia during Matariki, Aroha Nui, Kia Manuia, live long and prosper, and I'll talk with you again soon.
Good day. Yeah. tucy.tv. Why don't you stick around for more awesome radio?